tonight on Arena. Tara Rocht and Peter Whelan on the extraordinary story of castrato singer Ten Ducci and spoken word artist Adam Mohammed in studio. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Born in 1735, Giusto Fernando Ten Ducci became one of the most acclaimed operatic singers of the late Baroque period, a castrato. He made his professional debut in Venice at the age of 17, and his reputation grew widely across Europe in the subsequent years. He visited Ireland in the 1760s, and although embraced and celebrated to begin with as a performer on stage, and as a charismatic figure off stage, his reputation took on a different character altogether when he eloped with a 15-year-old student from Limerick, a young girl that he was teaching at the time. His subsequent fall from grace has provided the inspiration for a new CD by the Irish Baroque Orchestra featuring the voice of Tara Aracht. The CD is called The Trials of Ten Ducci, and with me this evening to talk about this amazing character is Tara Aracht and Peter Whelan, Artistic Director of the Irish Baroque Orchestra. You couldn't make this up in an opera, Tara Rocks, this story of this man.
You couldn't, but I mean, if you're going to find such drama, it could only be from an opera singer, let's be honest.
He really had the most colourful life and life story, which we'll go into in a little bit more detail. But let's talk about him as a singer first. I suppose, if you think in terms of modern-day pop stars, we're talking, you know, an Ed Sheeran, a Harry Styles. We're talking people fainting in the aisles listening to him sing and screaming up as he sang. That's the type of pop stardom we're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, 100%, without a question. And I mean, we have to remember that at that time, Dublin was an absolute hub for the Baroque music. And the reason all the artists like to come, both the performers and the composers, that they like to come and debut concert series and programmes in Ireland was because the audience were so welcoming and that they were always so interested. But to charm the Irish audience, you had to be a good storyteller. And I think that's the light bulb thing between myself and Ten Ducci. I really believe that we probably had the same reason to sing, and that was to tell a good story. He endeared himself very much to the public here.
Yeah, and very much... The style of the castrato voice, was it, Peter, really de rigueur, or was it very much a la mode at that time? Was it the voice that everybody wanted to hear in the 18th century?
As you were saying, it was like the kind of Beyonce style voice of the day. It was the one that people wanted to go and hear and would flock to go and hear, you know, this in-between voice, you know, between man and woman. And there's lots of descriptions of the kind of otherworldliness of this voice. And also it was an attractive voice, and there were attractive personalities for both men and women, and kind of it was okay to admire them publicly because of this, because they were kind of considered safe and different. But yeah, absolutely, he was a huge superstar, much bigger than any composer at the time. So people are really coming to hear the voice, and it's one of the, you know, the very first great operatic, or even, you know, pop star figures that we see, especially coming to Ireland.
In fact, what I wanted to, just to give a sense of the otherworldliness of the voice. Now, this is not from your CD, and it's not Ten Ducci himself. He wasn't alive, obviously, for the time. Recording technology wasn't placed. But one of the only recordings that we believe we have of a castrato voice is of Alessandro Moreschi. And this is he singing the Ave Maria. And you do get a sense, as you said, Peter, of the otherworldliness here. Oh, Yeah, otherworldly is one way of describing it for sure. The voice there of Alessandro Moreschi, that's the castrato voice. That was a recording made in 1903. We think he was in his late 40s at that point when he was singing and hitting those high
Amazing.
Notes. An extraordinary sound altogether. The practice of castration itself made illegal in the late 19th century. So 1903, obviously, mm-hmm. the latest time that we might get a voice like that. But you mm-hmm. then, Tara Iraoch, on this CD that we get from yourself and Peter and the Irish Baroque Orchestra, are you emulating that sound, or are you taking the music that would have been sung by the castrato voice and doing what you do as a soprano?
Oh, 100%. So we have to remember also at that time, women weren't allowed on the stage. So these poor little boys were treated in such a way so that they could play female roles also in the operas. Now, when they did the concerts, of course, they could do any sorts of repertoire, but in the operas they were in, either they were given quite a young man in a trouser role, or they sang women also. And of course, I do the opposite now. So I sing women and I sing young men. And I think that our voice types, like naturally my voice, the range is the exact same. He possibly, and they all possibly could sing maybe slightly higher than I. Mm. But certainly the younger Mezzi, I think it really should be almost the same as a castrato. As you grow older and everything, obviously the voice changes with hormones. The interesting thing for them, I mean, if we say this gentleman was in his 40s, and you can see how there were never hormonal changes on that instrument. It's an incredible, yeah. incredible thing to hear. We'll never hear such a thing live in our lifetime. But no, I certainly sang with my own voice and my own, you know, colour palette. And enjoyed every second of it, I have to say. The repertoire was so, I mean, it was the absolute rock music of the time. And especially in one or two of the arias, the bass lines are no different than you would hear now in a big hit. The bass line you'd still hear in a pop song or a rock yeah. song. It's this amazing kind of take over your soul music. It was incredible stuff.
I want to listen to a Giordani composition. This is Caro Mio Ben, very well known song. Now, this is sometimes referred to as an aria, but it wasn't that. It's not actually from an opera. It was just composed as a song, yeah?
It was indeed. And the interesting thing is every single singing student on the planet learns this, because it has these beautiful A vowels, O vowels and I vowels. And so they're really the foundations that we learn to sing on. And we've all sung it, we've all slogged over it for years, and you nearly come to dislike it as an exercise. And when I realised that it was composed for him, that he premiered it, that he
Tenducci,
brought it around
yeah.
the world, Tenducci, and that he had this, and must have had this beautiful vocal quality and technical ability to always be able to sing it. And it's such a treat now to get to sing it. I'm a little bit more established. My technique is established. And now I feel I can do it justice. Yeah. You didn't want to hear it, what I would have done to it 10 years ago.
Well, let's,
different situation now, I hope.
let's have a listen to it as it is then on the CD, The Trials of Tenducci, with the Irish Baroque Orchestra. Tara Iraoch, who's been speaking to us, and Peter Whelan, who's also with us, is conducting here as well. Just a little flavour of Caro Mio Ben from the composition of Giordani. Thankfully, a much more earthly sound than the unearthly sound we heard from Alessandro Moreschi earlier on. But let's get back to the story behind this man, Peter Whelan. As I said to Tara at the beginning of the item, you really couldn't make it up. So he's this big rock pop star coming to Dublin. Dublin, remember, this is where Handel's Messiah was first performed. So it really was a really important venue on the musical circuit at the time. But what type of... talk to me about his relationship with the young woman, because this is really at the heart of the Trials of Tenducci, isn't it?
Absolutely. And just to say as well that, you know, the reason he came to Dublin in the first place was to escape debtors in London. So he just escaped from jail in London.
of course, he was running away from something.
Yeah. And Dublin at that point, as you said, after Handel kind of opened the gates to composers and singers coming from abroad. And it was a lucrative spot to be. It was the second biggest city in the British Isles, and people had money to spend at that time. Of course, that's when, you know, the big squares were being built. In fact, he was teaching a girl who lived in the newly built Molesworth Street. So it was all part of this new city. People wanted to educate their kids with the best people in the business. And Tenducci was one of those. He taught Mozart how to sing. He gave Mozart a singing lesson when Mozart was only 10. So he had a very good credentials for the old teaching.
She was a 15-year-old girl. Dorothea Mansell was her name. And she adored him. She watched him every night from the side of the stage as he performed in Dublin, and she adored her teacher.
That's right. She would have watched him and been totally starstruck from watching from the sides in Smock Alley Theatre, seeing this guy. And then, she twisted her father's arm to teach, in Molesworth Street. And the father, I guess, thought he was safe with this eunuch in the house, you know. But of course, the two fell madly in love with each other. And the next thing we hear, they'd eloped to Cork to get married together. And this, of course, was a hugely scandalous event. And Mr. Monsell, a lawyer, chased the two down and had poor old Tenducci thrown into jail in Cork. They let him out for one night to do a concert and then threw him back in again. But he was having the absolute horrors in there, we hear.
He was allowed out for the concert. I'm interested in a couple of aspects of this. Firstly, from you, Peter, you believe that perhaps she was a 15-year-old girl. He was a man in his 30s at this stage. But you believe that the scandal at the time may have been more about religion than it was about the age difference and the fact that she was a minor, let's face it.
Well, there's so many things to choose from here. So she was a minor, that he was castrated. But actually, the big problem that we see in the papers is that it's a Catholic marriage, and that's the real problem. So they managed.
She was from Protestant stock, was she?
She was a Protestant background, and that was the panic. Nothing else in particular. So later on, once they managed to get the couple remarried a year later in the Protestant church, and that's the kind of that doused the flames of the scandal, which is really interesting for the time that the fact that she was so young was not a problem. It was more the mixed marriage, I guess you might.
Right, it might have been the term was that
the,
was used.
The real issue but involved.
I'm also equally delighted with your theories, Tara Arocht, around the fact there's a story about Casanova and this young woman as well, isn't there? And you have doubts as to whether Tenducci was in fact a castrato. You think he may have been? You tell us what you think.
I wonder. I mean, there's so many interesting facets to this story. You know, she ended up later on having children, and I mean, as I said to your researcher, God bless them. When they were castrated, there were witnesses. Obviously, somebody had to do it, and there'd be somebody there with the child and everything. I mean, what interests me in a musical sense, in that time, were they not aware of countertenors?
Yeah.
I know a countertenor, obviously, as they age, the hormones will affect their voice, and that is something. But even to use them earlier on in their careers on stage. So I often wonder, I mean, I find it incredibly interesting, maybe, you know, and there's so many different possibilities. But he lived such a colourful life, as did she. Because she was obviously also then exposed to his whole career and the travelling with it. And when they went back to London and all the things she experienced there were wild. I mean, raucous, you know.
Finally, the theory of the third testicle, Tara Arocht, is that belonging to you or is that belonging to Casanova?
Certainly was not mine, I can tell you.
it was Casanova who believed that Tenducci may have had a third testicle. You're both struck
right.
Peter.
Yeah, that's one theory that's going, because of course they even had proof. You know, the poor guy, in order to prove that the marriage wasn't consummated, the poor old you know, that the Monsells had to go all the way back to Italy and found the guy who did the snip, And that's how we know so much about the gory details about how people, you know, became castratos. So that was all part of the trial at the time. So I think it was Casanova being a bit cheeky, saying that maybe he had another one hidden away in order to have those kids. But who knows the truth behind it?
Absolutely. And who cares? It's too good a story that he might have been in such a state of physical endowment. Yeah. At any rate, it was a really good reason to make the CD and a really good story to be told. And thank you for sharing it with us this evening. That's Peter Whelan, Artistic Director of the Baroque Orchestra, and mezzo-soprano Tara Arock talking to us about their new CD based on this type of songs that might have been sung by the Italian castrato, or was he a countertenor, Tenducci. The CD is called The Trials of Tenducci, will be released on Saturday, March the 13th. Full details on irishbaroqueorchestra.com. Adam Muhammad is an Irish Sudanese artist from Ballymun in Dublin. He uses his words to explore his class, race, religion and vulnerability, both in spoken word and hip-hop mediums. His piece, Untitled, was his debut at the end of last year. Adam is in studio just down the hall from me. We'll speak to him shortly. But first of all, let's have a listen to that Untitled work.
Where do I fit? What is my place? Is a half-caste? Mixed race? Brown? Tan? Black? White? But it was never just black or white. It was a grey area with a silver lining. It was in between the lines I found myself hiding. My name is Adam Muhammad. I'm named after the first male and the prophet, Christian and Muslim. You wanna know where I come from? It's the jungle, the concrete jungle. See, these days, different is cool. It wasn't when I was in school. I carried a board, the lines were blurred in. Hate from mates was turned inside and stored in. Like, why don't I have pure skin? Why does my hair curl in? Do I pray on a mat or at mass? Take an Easter feast or a Ramadan fast? Learn about Sudan's dodgy sands or Bobby Sands? See, there's too many contradictions that cause afflictions. The only way out is to find your way out. Through the shame and pain, my mind frame sprouts. From why don't I have pure skin? My skin is the purest, one with all that exists. Pure bliss. I'm that Northside Nubian, so stand aside and see the beauty in the space that I create for myself to be in. We call it an up the flats mentality from an African magistrate. And while the flats eroded and crumbled, I arose triumphant with the spirit of Dublin and Khartoum. Salam alaikum. Cut on scale. If you can't see through the veil, then down the veil. Because all in all, we have more in common than different. That doesn't make for headlines or sound bites. White privilege, black power, it's all lives matter. White guilt, a black shame, sure it's all pain. We look left and right, but there's little truth in absolutes. So we stay in the centre, but never on the fence. And that's not being spiteful, but some things are just best left untitled.
Untitled, the title of that amazing work from Adam Muhammad, who, as I say, is in a studio just down the corridor from me this evening here in Arena. It's an extraordinary piece, Adam. I had to listen to it 3, 4, 5 times today just to start to explore the subtleties and the ideas that you're going into there. But that opening line, those opening questions, where do I fit? What is my place? Have you been asking yourselves those questions for a long time?
Yeah, it would have been. It's one of the kind of biggest questions I had. And now, after doing this and figuring out kind of where I'm from and what's my place, I'm realising that, you know, a lot of people are, that's their main question as well. And, you know, we're all on this journey together. So it's something I've only realised when we put it out that, you know,
yeah, it's one of the conclusions I suppose you come to in the piece, this idea that everybody has pain no matter who you are, everybody has these questions to ask of themselves. Mm-hmm. But yours are particularly interesting, mm-hmm. I would have thought. Again, in the middle of the piece, you talk about nowadays difference is cool, wasn't that way when I was at school. What kind of experience did you have then growing up? What difficulties or what challenges were there for you?
Just being in, like, being from Ballymun, that was a challenge in itself. Like, you know, manoeuvring through the streets and trying to find my own way, and then obviously looking like me. There's not many people. There wasn't many people back then around that did look like me. So, just dealing with that and trying to explore that. And
did you get a lot of grief about it? I mean, let's tell me a little bit about the background. I mentioned Irish Sudanese in the introduction, and you mentioned within the piece as well Adam and Muhammad, that Christian and Muslim aspect to your very names.
Yeah.
Is that there in your background, that those two aspects?
Yeah, mixed race, mixed religion. Mam side would be, you know, normal Dublin Christian. Dad side would be Sudanese Muslim. So I've always had those two bits in me. And then just speaking about grief then, when I was growing up, yeah, I would have gotten grief, but something that I was only thinking as well is that, you know, everyone got grief, like, no matter kind of what you look like. You know, if you look like me, you got grief. If you had glasses, you got grief. If you have red hair, you got grief. Your clothes are looking a bit funny, you got grief over that as well. So
those who want to find something to pick on will just find it and go for it immediately. But for you growing up, I'm presuming for you it was as normal as anything. For you, your mother was who she was, your father was who he was, and therefore you were the product of that union. So I presume you wanted both parts to be equally expressed and equally expressive.
Yeah, 100%. You know, it's me. The two sides or the two parts make me, which is the whole. So it's something that I really wanted to express in Untitled, that you know, how to you know, have those two parts in me, two sometimes conflicting parts when you look through it, and then merging those into one.
Maybe so. Conflicting for lots of other people, maybe not so conflicting for you in some ways. Other people's attitudes perhaps made them conflicting, did they?
Yeah, well, you know yourself, Christian, Muslim, you know, that whole thing, and, you know, some of the things that have been happening over the last few years, it's just been good to, you know, explore that and kind of merge it into one and tackle that.
The other aspect of you that is quite interesting, not in terms of ethnic background or cultural background in any way, is the fact that you graduated from the National College of Ireland in 2016 with a business degree. Is work in business running alongside this spoken word art that clearly you have a real strength for? When did that interest start in spoken word?
Well, it started from a pretty young age. Like, it was, you know, I've always, you know, been into reading. I've always, English, you know, was one of my best, you know, one of the subjects that I've done the best at in school. History as well, something that I really enjoy, something that I'm looking to, you know, something that I'd be looking to teach in the future as well. So I've always enjoyed kind of writing essays and stuff like that. And then when I first actually, made my own spoken word piece, I was in the Axis in Ballymun. Not sure if you've heard of it. I was doing a project with a few guys out there, and I was actually being mentored by Stephen James Smith, and he was getting us all, just, you know, it was a project, just lads with me from, you know, all other kind of different backgrounds, and we all wrote something. And that was the first thing that we ever wrote. It was in 2016. I was about 21, so, you know, I wasn't young, and that was when I first realised that I could actually write something. And, you know, probably looking back now, if I was to say it, it probably wasn't even good, but just the fact that I had that in me, that we could do that and make something sound good, that was big. That was really big for me.
Yeah, and you mentioned Stephen James Smith there, and Damien Dempsey, I know, was also involved in your mentorship. But you've been inspired by Denise Chyla and Gemma Dunleavy. And difficult not to mention that Gemma Dunleavy, given that you talk about the up the flats mentality in the midst of your piece as well.
Exactly, yeah. And the up the flats thing, that's always been there. Like, that's just the saying. You hear people that aren't from the flats saying that. But it was good to hear, with Gemma, it was good to hear... Mm. someone just kind of, you know, expressing their love for that background on, you know, everywhere, and that's something that we wouldn't have seen. And then with Denise as well, just seeing she had a piece called the Dual Citizenship, and that would have been really kind of inspirational for me.
How amazing then that it is with them that you're performing at the St. Patrick's Festival. That must have been quite an exciting moment for you to really realize
yeah,
that you're
yeah,
in the same
building. Yeah, performing with Gemma. Yeah.
Gemma's part of your performance. That's all done and in the can now. I presume we'll get Untitled. Will we get other work as well in that performance, Adam?
Yeah, you will. So we performed three tracks. So there was Untitled. There was another spoken word piece called Alchemy, and then there's a new track. It's a rap with a bit of singing as well. It's called Me, Myself, and I. And yeah, we worked me and my guys, Mark Logan and Matt Steele, we worked really hard to make sure it all flowed into a nice piece. And hopefully the album that I'm going to be coming out with soon, you know, we're going to continue that journey. So this is just like a little sneak peek at that.
Yeah, well, I'm really looking forward to that album, and I hope you'll talk to us about it when it does come out. But just one final question before I let you go, Adam. You travelled to Sudan a few years ago. Mm-hmm. How important was that journey in terms of adding, particularly to your creative voice, and maybe helping you to express your identity in a fuller way?
It was so important because, you know, I didn't travel there until I was 18. So I went from, you know, I went up to 18, not knowing about the other side of me, and then to travel there and see, like, you know, black people just out there, you know, loving themselves and just living the way they do, was really big for me. And I drawed some big comparisons to Ireland with Sudan, like just the sense of you know, hospitality and community, two very big things over in Sudan as well. So it was good to see that.
Yeah, well, as in many areas of life, there's more that unites us than divides us. Lovely to have spoken with you this evening, Adam. Thanks a million for
coming
in to chat.
Thanks for having me.
That's Adam Mohammed, and you can catch Adam's performance. I'm really looking forward to hearing the other pieces as well. He'll be there with Pillow Queens and Gemma Dunleavy on SPTV. St. Patrick's TV on Saturday, March the 13th at 8 p.m, Wednesday, March the 17th at 6:30 p.m. And you can find out full details about all of that on stpatricksfestival.ie. The Grass Arena, a memoir written by writer John Healy, was a touchstone book for many who came of age in the late 1980s and early 90s. It told the story of John Healy's life as a second-generation Irishman, his descent into alcoholism, and ultimately a redemption of sorts through his mastery of chess, which he learned to play in Pentonville Prison. It was published in 1988 at a moment when the music of the Pogues first reached a mass audience, and like the music, the words of Shane McGowan, the Grass Arena book seemed like a significant statement of London Irish identity. 10 years ago, filmmaker Paul Dwan made the critically acclaimed feature documentary Barbaric Genius about John Healy, and now to mark the decade since its premiere at the 2011 Dublin International Film Festival, the film is being re-released to stream on digital platforms, and filmmaker Paul Dwan joins me now. Paul, maybe first of all, talk to us a little bit about the effect that the Grass Arena had on so many people in, you know, at around the time it was published in the late 80s, and then subsequently in the early 90s. You were one of those who was very much of the generation that picked it up and was bowled over by it. What was so extraordinary about the book, first of all?
Well, the thing about it is, you know, London was a very alien place to people like myself then. I mean, we didn't have the cheap air travel and all that. So when I went to London, it was the first foreign trip I'd ever made. And I found myself in this strange world where expatriate Irish builders had gone sort of feral, you know, because they were far from their home and far from their conception of morality. And it shocked me. And it was fascinating to see how, you know, people could feel very unmoored. The London Irish, whether the first or second generation, kind of lost their moorings when they went over there. Because this is before, you know, telephone calls were expensive and there was certainly no internet. So that was a world I really hadn't seen chronicled. And then, you know, as you say, the Pogues, but to an even greater degree, John Healy's book, The Grass Arena, was probably the first time that anybody had put that world on paper and done it brilliantly. The book is astonishingly well written. You know, the opening line, you know, my father looked like the kind of man who wouldn't hit anyone. That's a great opening line, you know.
And you know, and where it's going to when you hear a line like that, you know that you're going to hear the opposite story as the book progresses.
Absolutely. It's great storytelling. You lean in, you know. So John was a born writer, but he was born without any of the other prerequisites, without a real education, without family support, and of course with a propensity for alcohol. So his survival after living on the streets, and literally this wasn't a kind of, you know, a couple of lost weekends. This was years sleeping in parks, being locked up, being used as a drug testing experiment by doctors who were trying to, you know, experiment with antabuse and getting people off alcohol. All these extraordinary gothic horror, like something out of Dickensian London stories that happened in the 60s, you know.
Let's have a listen to John, actually, from quite early on in the film. I think probably one of the first days you got him to sit down and to talk to camera with you. And this is how he introduces himself.
My name's John Healy, and I was born in London in 1942. My parents were Irish, came from Sligo, and I had a very violent childhood, and I'd started drinking when I was about 15, and in the end I ended up drinking on the streets. Well, drinking on the streets then, it wasn't like what drinking now. All winos were muggers. It was robbery with violence. I was there 15 years, in and out of prison, and a burglar known as the Brighton Fox taught me to play chess. It's a mental opiate, chess, and it altered my life, actually. I started to play in chess matches and tournaments, so I never took a drink after that. I got this desire to write something. And gradually, after a year, I had a book. It sold nearly 20,000 copies. Then it was made into a film, and it won the Best British Feature Film. And the book was suddenly taken out of print.
Even in that 1 minute and 15 seconds, what a storyteller he is. He packs his entire life almost into that clip from Barbaric Genius, which is the film we're speaking about this evening with its director, Paul Dwan. It is extraordinary what he packs in there, from the violent upbringing to the drink, to prison, to chess, to writing a book, to being out of print. Just give us a sense, if you could, Paul, of how the book was huge success and then suddenly we hear nothing.
Well, you're talking about a time when, you know, writers would turn up on primetime TV. I mean, John was interviewed by Jonathan Ross, you know, on TV. Mm. He was a fixture on chat shows because he was charismatic. He was youthful at that point. He was in his 40s, I think. He's a very funny man. He's very, very good company. And he got lots and lots of media attention, you know, full page Observer interview, all that kind of stuff. And the book was a number one bestseller. The book was an absolute runaway hit. And then the book was adapted as a film. And it was it won the top feature film award at the Edinburgh Film Festival and launched the career of, oh my God, my mind's gone blank, that fantastic British actor who's now in Spielberg films and so on. I've gone blank. I'll come back to it. But, you know, he basically was, everything he touched turned to gold. Yeah. And then suddenly everything stopped. And as he said in the film, it just went away. And my question was, why did that happen? How can somebody have such an extraordinary level of not just celebrity, but literary success based on genuine ability? And then it just goes quiet and they disappear.
Yeah. So the book was published, like, we're not talking about that it was published by a small publishing house. It was published by Faber, and then there was a subsequent reissue, wasn't there, with Penguin Modern Classics. So we're talking about mainstream publishing houses and all of the machinery that would have been involved there. So you go searching, Paul, for the answer to this question, and the man you're going to have to try to get it from to a large extent is John Healy. How would you describe the type of subject John Healy was to make a documentary with?
Well, towards the end of the film, I sort of say to John, look, the problem. The reason I've been filming for nearly five years without stopping is because every time I turn on the camera, you change personality and become much more evasive and you become difficult to pin down and you don't answer questions straight. You know, off camera, absolutely brilliant, hilarious, straightforward. And he says, oh, it must be all the years I spent being interrogated by cops. You know, I just clam up when I'm questioned. And that's part of the answer. But also, there's a certain amount of fear. I mean, it's a lot of people had, John had kind of trusted people along the way. I mean, editors, filmmakers, whatever. And a lot of the time, his story had been told in a distorted way. I was trying my best to tell the story in a way that was honest and truthful, but without distorting his voice. And it took a long, long time. You know, it was the hardest. I've made a lot more films since then. This is by far the hardest film I've ever made. I hope I never have to make one as difficult.
Well, let's listen to another clip then, which gives us a sense of, because at times you think, well, he's opening up and he's going to tell us everything here. And I thought that was starting to happen when you went to St. Martin's Gardens with him, which was a particular area of London where he would have spent a lot of time with other drinkers in his early life. Let's listen to his response when he gets there.
What age would you have been when you came here?
I don't know. I was hopping in and out. I used to drink with winos and then think, well, you know, these guys and women, these people are mad. They're barbarians. They're crazy. You couldn't live with them. And I'd be able to hop out, you know, because I looked, I was young and I could go thieving and drinking pubs and get away with it. And then eventually I couldn't drink in pubs, they wouldn't let me in, I was too violent. And then I ended up permanently with the winos, I couldn't leave them then. And I was one of them, so I became one of them.
It was when you were in your
20s? So in my 20s, yeah.
Another clip there from Barbaric Genius, the Paul Dwan film about the writer John Haley, and Paul Dwan speaking to me this evening, celebrating the 10-year anniversary of that. 10 years on, have you had any contact with John Haley in the intervening years? Paul, have you got any closer to solving the question that you tried to answer 10 years ago?
Well, there are two different answers to that question, I guess. Yes, I have absolutely stayed in touch with John. I'm very fond of John. I feel, you know, I mean, he's a difficult man to be close to because he is quite spiky, but he's a very rewarding friend. You know, he's a good man that, you know, when I go to London, in the days when you could go to London, I would, you know, often meet up with him for a coffee and catch up, and he would make me laugh with his extraordinary anecdotes. The mystery of what happened to him is in the film, and I think it's largely, well, I mean, I was inspired to make the film in 2007, I was sitting in a friend's house reading the Sunday papers, and the Observer ran a small piece about how John had been invited to speak at the Court Festival in Galway.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's unusual for the Observer to run a piece about an Irish literary festival in such detail, but they ran an anonymous piece saying, I wonder if the organisers realise what they're letting themselves in for by inviting this character to appear. Right. And that sort of piqued my interest. Why would somebody have such a vendetta so many years later against this man?
And as you said, there is an answer within the film, but let the people see that when they get to see it. So Barbaric Genius is the film that Paul Dwan has been speaking to us about. And thanks so much for that.
His leather jacket had chains that would jingle. They both met movie stars, partied and mingled. Their A&R man said, I don't hear a single. The future was wide open.
Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers there with the song Into the Great Wide Open, which has that line, their A&R man said, I don't hear a single. A&R, of course, stands for Artist and Repertoire, and A&R people are among the key decision makers in the music business, discovering, signing and helping to develop talent. Now, in a profession that relies on, you would guess, musical and commercial knowledge, and I would think to a large extent, gut instinct, is it the case that it might be somewhat insulated from the technological juggernaut which has eliminated so many other professions? Well, think again. An Irish company called Anderson has developed an app.
a kind of technology that will identify and recommend aspiring talent to record companies and others. Neil Dunn is one of the founders of the company and he joins me now. Bye-bye A&R man, it sounds like, Neil.
Absolutely not, no. But we are Anderson. We look after providing bespoke analysis results to A&R individuals. So rather than replacing A&Rs, which is something we don't want to do, we try and enhance their discovery experience by getting them back to what we believe and they believe matters most. And that's the music rather than passive things like social media metrics.
All right. So you, I presume, aren't sitting down and listening to every piece of music that is out there on the internet. The app or some piece of technology is doing it, doing that for you. What does the app look for? Do you put in parameters that suggest this is going to be a great fast song, this is going to be a great pop song, this is going to be a great late night listen? What do you do on the app?
So in the app, it's really, really simple. Artists sign up with a traditional profile and then they upload their songs. And we look after absolutely everything ourselves. So our software analyzes the purely audio elements of each song and pulls out things that make that track unique. Things that, as music lovers, we understand, like beats per minute, tonality, the key, chord progression, instrumentation. But subjective things like listening behavior or social stats don't come into it at all. Neither do keyword tags. So when you upload, we complete that same analysis on a track, and then it's simply just a percentage similarity to existing hits.
So the kind of underlying suggestion here is if you have the right number of beats per minute, if you write it in the right key, if you have the correct chord progressions, etc., etc., there you go. There's your hit. Sorted.
If only life were that simple. So we do take in other factors like production quality as well as vocal similarity. Our team has an extensive knowledge of musicology. Corrick, our head of audio analysis, has worked under organizations like Microsoft, as well as working for one of the former leading in AI and music. And what we're now very, very proud to say is that our audio engine is actually now the most accurate analysis comparative engine globally. Which for a company that's only been in market for 6 months, we're incredibly proud of.
I'm wondering to what extent, Neil, does your app, the Anderson app, does it replicate or have some of the same ideas as Shazam? I suppose people will be more familiar with this as a technology. You know, you have it on your phone, whatever, you're walking around the supermarket, you hear a song, or you hear a song on the radio, in fact. I should be advertising that as well, shouldn't I? And you put the the phone up against the radio, and there you go, it gives you the title of the song, and you go, ah, yeah, that's the name of it. Oh, yeah, I must seek out that artist, I must find out more about them. Is it something similar? I mean, that's about identifying. Are you you're going further than just identifying a track?
Exactly. It's similar, but different. Shazam does an exact match. So exactly as your example, if you hear a great song on the radio and you want to add it to your Spotify playlist, you can hold your phone up and it tells you there and then, unless you've got a fantastic radio presenter like Sean who's telling you what the track is. What we're trying to do is put the power of discovery back into industry professionals' hands. So they know that they're looking for a female pop act. They know that their label is loving the sound of Ariana Grande, Charlie XCX, Dua Lipa, and they're looking for that next act to fit into that under that criteria. So rather than doing an exact match of that's Ariana Grande, it's like, why not give me 20 artists that sound similar to her within the island of Ireland? And Anderson gives you that list of artists that match within a range of similarity.
You see, there's a side of me that says, but surely what I want is not 20 artists who sound the same as somebody who's had a big hit, and not 20 artists who can replicate that type of sound or that type of beat, those number of beats per minute, etc., etc. I'm looking for somebody, in fact, who makes me go, wow, what's that? That's different from everything else I've been hearing. That made me sit up in my seat and take note.
Absolutely. And I think that's the most amazing thing about music, is that No one artist is divine, no one artist is prescribed by one influence. But we all understand that keys do have a limit, and that there are like certain songs exist at 128 beats per minute. That is EDM music. So that does create a similarity. But what is most exciting for us is when we look at our platform, it's not one artist being 99% similarity. You could have 56% similarity to Dua Lipa, with influences like 76% similarity to David Bowie and 33% similarity to Beyonce. But again, that's what makes up that identity of an artist. All the influences coming from different areas. But ultimately, what we've created is trying to make a more meaningful connection with the art, rather than what currently A&R are relying on is just being spitted viral artists. And obviously that can be such a subjective and less meaningful form of discovery for musicians.
Let's have a listen to one of the artists then that is currently on your platform. This is Test Card Girl. And we listen to a little bit of a track called Holds Me Down.
The love in your eyes is a surprise to me. It buckles my knees and it holds me down. Although it was light, it won't sever the ties for me. It's like a disease and it holds me down.
Okay, that's just the opening section there of a track called Holds Me Down from Test Card Girl. Test Card Girl being one of the artists on the Anderson Music app, which is an app that is going to do all the work for the A&R guys and girls, I suppose, the men and women of the A&R profession, by seeking out new talent, or certainly suggesting new talent that might be successful in the future. And Neil Dunn of Anderson is with me this evening. Now, when I listen to that, I hear that opening beat, the synthy beat at the top. Then I hear the great lyrics that come in about, you know, the knees buckling or whatever it was around love and health. Yeah, there's something there, okay, that kind of catches my ear. Now, what did the app do, or what do you guys do with a track like that, Neil? What do you send on to potential record companies as a response to that piece of music?
Yeah, so a lovely example. So Tesco Girl uploads their song and they exist in our database. What happens next is our industry professionals come onto the app, onto our platform, and begin searching for music. And funnily enough, Test Car Girl, one of our success cases from last year, where a podcast producer was looking for a soundtrack that sounded similar to Bombay Bicycle Club, and Test Car Girl Holds Me Down popped up, and they've actually synced that track at the beginning of one of their new podcasts, which launched at the end of last year. So yeah, that's probably where that synthy sound is coming in through. But that's how it works.
I mean, there's a side of me that really admires what it is. There's another side of me that fears that there still is this underlying suggestion, 25% of that, 14% of the other thing, a little 36% of that, and you can break it all down in that fashion. Is there not really some unknown ingredient, something that even the A&R people find hard to put their finger on? Is there not some subjective side that's really needed here in amongst all the percentages and all the technical data?
100%. And that's, again, what we're about. We don't make decisions for the industry professionals, because ultimately, when you're looking at technology, and especially in the music industry, we believe the most powerful instrument to be the human ear. And it's up to our trusted professionals to make the right decisions, and their gut instinct is always going to come into this. What we're trying to do is purely bring things, their decision process, their searching, their filtering, make that process easier so that they can do their work. All industry professionals know how much time they waste trawling through social media, searching through Spotify, where they have to either luckily land across someone in an editorial playlist or search for their name. So discovering those unheard gems is increasingly difficult in a digital world. Yeah. But you're 100% right. Gut instinct and human intuition will always be the ones that make that decision.
and a bit of listening, I suppose, is essential as well. You might finish up, Neil, by actually telling us a little bit about Abby Coulibaly, who's another one of the artists on the platform.
Absolutely, yeah. Abby, an amazing talent. She signed up to the platform this year. She was also actually selected as one of our top acts on the platform by our panel of industry judges. She is also in the running for winning up to €10,000 as part of our songwriting contest. But she is on the platform, and I know that she's actually been searching for studio musicians for an upcoming session on the platform. And there are absolutely great things coming for Abby this year.
All right, that's great, Neil. Thanks for speaking to us this evening. And let's finish up with a track from Abby called Taurus. Abby Coulibaly and Taurus. I think it's time to make a change with you. And if you want to be friends, that's cool. Your shit, so can you really blame me? It's not personal, just know I'm not your lady, cause I don't like to play these games with you. No, I'd rather be by myself, I'd rather find someone else. Why you trying to call me, wasting all my time? You know I'm in my zone. There we go, Abby Coulibaly there with her single Taurus, one of the many thousands of tracks hosted on the digital A&R platform Anderson that Neil Dunn was telling us about there. You can find out full details about that platform on anderson.com, and that's Anderson, by the way, without the letter E, A-N-D-R-S-O-N. And earlier we were speaking about Barbaric Genius, the film, the Paul Dwan film about John Healy, the writer. It is available currently on iTunes and Apple TV and on general digital release. Mark Rylance, by the way, was the British actor that Paul was searching for. That was the name he was looking for. But that is our lot for this evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Dave Gibson was in sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGann. Bemé Rash Liv, Shot the Clug, Iha Mark on Shot RTE Radio.